We were talking about microaggressions, micro offenses, and it's rather short on examples. Some of you may be able to help me, but I did find some online. And actually, this website is on your handout. So here's microaggression number one. Can you see as much as white people? You know, like because of your eyes? That was her. That's moving kind of fast there. But okay, there's the microaggression. These are self-submitted. Why do you sound so white? There would be a microaggression right there. Can you read this? He showed me a Japanese character. This was my favorite, I guess. If I can get it to... You're really pretty for a black girl. I'm sorry, folks. This thing is moving faster than I'd like it to, and I can't seem to control it. Well, you get the idea. You might want to go and look some of those up. So you're Chinese, right? I assume that the microaggression there was because she is Asian. That was the only Asian word that someone could come up with. But one of the reasons I show you this is Brenna talked to me during the break, and we touched on the topic of a microaggression that I've actually wondered about. I apologize for that, folks. If I stay behind the line, I'll be okay. Brenna, would you mind telling us about that a little bit? Just our few minutes was actually instructive for me, and it would probably be for other folks as well.
Okay, so can you guys hear me? Okay, Dr. R, as he was talking.
This is Brenna Weaver, ladies and gentlemen. She graduated from our program 3 years ago.
2014.
That's only 2 years ago, and she worked in the center, Barb's assistant, and she took care of Oscar rather frequently. My dog loves Brenna, so he misses her.
So as Dr. R was speaking about just having a cultural blind spot, I was thinking, I've had several people say to me, I'm colorblind, like I don't even see your color, so it's not an issue. And they're meaning that in a positive way to say, I'm not racist. Like, I don't see your blackness. And there's a part of me that wonders whenever I hear that, what really does that mean? Because I know that the person, like, I know you see that I'm a black person. And so is that my question to Dr. R and trying to turn it over in my mind is that a way of dismissing having to address cultural and racial issues? So I don't see your color, so I don't have an issue, so there's nothing for me to learn.
Yeah. Nothing for me to learn, right? I got you all figured out. Maybe it means, oh, you're just like me. And your experience is just like mine. If that would be the case, I would think that could be a micro, maybe even a macro aggression.
Hi,
Erin.
My name is Erin. I am a former student, and I'm currently in church with some of you lovely people.
At Redeemer.
At Redeemer, mm-hmm. Which is a wonder. That, well, never mind. I'll skip that. It's wonderful. I also, the majority of my counseling experience the last 3 years has been cross-cultural. Mm-hmm. Primarily, I've usually only been the only white person in the room. And what Brenna was saying that made me raise my hand is it's also the case. I'm not from this area. I'm from Metro Atlanta and was raised to be colorblind. in contrast, my husband is from North Mississippi. He's from Tupelo and was raised very segregated from the African American folks in his town. But in school, his experience was one where he almost, I guess, got some kind of like compassion fatigue or exhaustion from being taught so frequently, totally appropriately. But he was taught through especially literature about the history of Mississippi. And the message that he heard, I don't think it was intended, but the message that he heard, or what became a barrier for him, was that he should feel personal guilt, or that white people are bad, which, I mean, we are just like everybody else. But for him, that experience became a big barrier to actually addressing his own bias or engaging with people who were different from himself, because he thought, if I approach learning about someone else who's different from me, I have to acknowledge that I'm evil in this way. Or if I have to approach learning about someone who's different from myself, I have to think about my great grandfather who went to stop Dr. Meredith from joining the University of Mississippi.
It's like you're guilty to it.
Yes. So for him, part of becoming a member of Redeemer, which is multicultural, or part of engaging in other activities in, as an adult, has involved having to face a lot of grief and take up, I think, a teeny tiny bit of an emotional burden that some of our brothers and sisters have no choice but to experience. So part of him becoming, and me too, but he's a more dramatic example, or an easier to summarize example. Part of his work in becoming engaged with friends who are different from him, being in our church, has been having to lay down some of his privilege of not grieving, of not having to think about these things daily, and take up his cross with his brothers and sisters, much smaller than theirs in this area, and grieve and have, I think, just have a tiny bit of the experience that maybe Tosh or Brenna might have when there's a headline about someone in your group being shot by the police. That now that he wants to be more open, now that he wants to learn, he has to do some emotional work. Whereas being colorblind, you can avoid that work. You can, it's not as burdensome.
Okay. Thank you, ladies. I want to, yes. Yes, Stephanie. Tell her, Stephanie.
Marty and I were talking about this, the survey, the one that we did, the last one that we did. And as I was taking it, I told her I was wondering how each one of us in this room answered those questions. You were from that study, but how did we look at various things? Did we look at institutionalization, and how do we see institutionalization? Did we look at it individually, and how does that factor to us as individuals when we are saying whether we agree or disagree? And I think that would be something good that we looked at individually and really sat there with it. One word that keeps coming across is the word prejudice, and people like to say they're not prejudiced. Each and every one of us is prejudiced, because you have to look at what the definition of prejudice is. Prejudice is a preconception, a stereotype that you have about a group. It doesn't necessarily mean a racial group. You know, the Olympics just came up, and I always use this example in teaching. The Olympics come up. Now, the Russians could be rated the world expert and everything, but we're Americans, and so we're just going to say, no, they're not. We're going to be rooting for us, and we know that we're going to win. Well, in that case, I'm prejudiced. And so we have to look at that. Here in Mississippi, I think we don't want to look at those kinds of things because we have to look at the past. One of the things I would invite you all to do I saw a screening of the movie the other night, The Nat Taylor Story. It's about the birth of a nation. And I would invite all of you to go and look at that movie, go and see that movie. But also the challenge I'm going to give to you, Dr. R, and here at RTS, is that your students go and go see that movie when it comes out, and you all engage in a discussion. It's historical, although it's from Virginia and Carolina, but it's historical, and it gives you the information about how African Americans feel, how they think. And as you're talking to people of different cultures and different races, then you get that information. You want to know, why is it that blacks mistrust? Look at the Tuskegee stories. You need to give that kind of information to people as you're teaching them about the multicultural.
Stephanie, was that the name of the movie, The Tuskegee Story?
No, The Birth of a Nation. The
Birth of a Nation
is the story about Nat Turner. But I'm saying, look at also the information about the Tuskegee story and the syphilis and how that was done. And so that's where you get mistrust from.
Well, you all are leading me to a mini segue here back to this piece. Number 17, what evangelical persons or groups are or have been involved in the racial reconciliation movement? Anyone have anything for that? Mission Mississippi, right here in town? Yeah. Well, the one that came up for me, it's Promise Keepers. Any of you familiar with Promise Keepers? That what's their Ron? You are what's their home organization, or they come out of Crew or what exactly? Campus Crusade for Christ. The new name, Ron. We're old. Okay, well, Promise Keepers is a national organization for men, connecting with men and learning the gospel and sharing the gospel, and they had a significant emphasis on racial reconciliation. And one of the interesting things about Promise Keepers was that they did some wonderful things at some wonderful meetings and conferences, but in the eyes of these authors that I was referencing, they stopped. They got stuck at the individual phase. The remedy was get to know someone who's African American. Spend time with them. Invite them over for dinner, Annie Bingham. You invite me for dinner is what I meant. And by the way, at the break, Ann Bingham, who's a longtime friend, graduate of this program, she and Maurice, her husband, ministered in so many ways in this Jackson community. Just want to let you know, she invited me over for dinner, and you could do the same. No, that's not why I'm telling you. Just a further testimony to my blindness. I've only been to dinner or lunch or any meal in an African American person's house one time in my entire life in America. That is, in the. The islands, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, where Barb and Jim have been too. Yeah, all kinds of houses, eating all kinds of interesting things. Great adventure. But when I was in college, a black couple invited me over for lunch. They were from the Bahamas, and we had conch soup, and it was delicious. So how blind am I? I've not been to dinner at Annie's house, and is that amazing? I mean, for 28 years, and it just never happened, or I never invited myself. It's not an indictment against anyone. It's simply a testimony to how completely, I think, people from white and black cultures can miss each other, and and be stuck with the assumption that they don't miss each other, that they actually understand one another. Peter and I mentioned something, or Peter mentioned to me during the break. Peter, would you mind bringing that up again?
Sure. I don't know where the mic is, so I'll just try to talk loud.
Good.
My question in all this is, how do we fix the, you know, we're talking about systemic issues, but how do we fix systemic issues without fixing the individuals? Because anytime you try to fix it from a system level, you have to call it out. Just like in some ways, hope it's okay to say this, that we've done today.
Oh, Peter, hang on just a second. I forgot to complete my segue. Segue was the Promise Keepers, their remedy was spend time with someone. And then, but there was no look toward any social structural change. And then, and Peter's question to me was, then pick it up. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, so if we try to fix it from a systemic level, you actually bring it out even more. So like even our discussion today, how many times have we individualized people based on their race, trying to gain understanding? And so to me, the gospel question and the systems question are not so separate. Because if individuals don't get the gospel, we can't fix the systems. And drawing on his classroom illustration, that if the teacher had stopped that boy walking up the aisle before he got to him, and said, look, we're not going to do this. We are going to love on this boy even though he's black. It would have caused the problem to be even bigger than letting it work out on an individual level. Does that make sense?
And so, why would it have been bigger? Why would the problem have been bigger?
Because he didn't see him as different.
Okay.
And maybe even that boy didn't see himself as different, and he affirmed that. But had the teacher stopped the situation and then called it out, she would have told everybody that this boy's different, and we're not going to make him feel that way, but just by saying that, you did.
Well, but she could have called it out without saying, you're going to let this little black boy sit next to you. She could have easily said, all right, class, there are clearly open seats. He can sit here.
Yes, that would have been great. But from a systemic level, like if we're going to write laws to fix segregation or racism, how do you write those laws in a way that doesn't call it out? Because you can't systematize it without bringing it out even deeper.
There are already laws in place saying you can't discriminate.
Right.
And so what you have to do is you have to make sure that people are abiding by the policies that are in place.
Yes.
And so every organization, I would assume, in corporate America has affirmative action. And just so you know, women benefit more from affirmative action than any other minority group. And so you have to recognize that when you hire someone, you're following proper, appropriate procedure. Mm-hmm. And it's not, hey, let's go out and find 10 women to hire, but it's acknowledging, okay, this is a woman applying for this job. She has the qualifications. And just so you know, affirmative action is not the person has lower qualifications. It's an equal match. They are by all means qualified for the position, but it's just, okay, she's qualified, let's bring her on board. And so there are laws and policy and procedures in place. It's making sure people have, they recognize their heart issue and that they're following it.
Can I ask you one more thing? Yeah. Again, I'm working my hardest to try to not let racism drive anything that I do. I like the phrase, relationships of mutual respect, mm-hmm. to where I don't see you just as black. There's a whole lot more to you than your color. Mm-hmm. There's the way that you grew up. There's your family background. There's any trauma that you might have experienced. There's all kinds of things in your life. I want to expand. I want to look at all of that and not just boil it down to one simple thing. But I've got a friend of mine who is in business who knows that he cannot move up because of his color, and he's white.
And how does he know that?
Because he's been in the business, and he knows that there's a ratio in place, and that ratio is not at the level that he can actually get the job. It has to be somebody of another color that gets the job, or the affirmative action will be out of balance.
So that's written explicitly in their policy? Because I would think his recourse would be able to, he should be able to go to HR and say, this is what I've observed, is this happening? And I recognize there's politics in a corporation, and so knowing that you should be able to do this doesn't mean that you will do it and that there won't be ramifications if you do call it out. But it doesn't make sense to me that he would say, oh, I can't move up in this company because I'm a white person. But I also recognize that there are other minorities who think, I can't move up in this company because I'm a black person. So it goes both ways. But again, if the company is holding to their structure appropriately, then that should be an issue they should be able to address.
It gets so dicey and confusing for me at points like this. But all my life, I came to Christ in teenage years, a very conservative evangelical group. All my life, my training as an evangelical has been, those are so confusing, and that's not our main job anyway. Our main job is to share the gospel, and when people's hearts change, it'll all be fine. And if they don't, the Lord's coming back anyway. I grew up in a dispensational theology. Which Barb won't let go of either. Barb's like, I'm Presbyterian, says Barb, but I'm going with the dispensationalists. We want the Lord to come back now. I'm not going to go with that tribulation period. Anyway, so I think all my life, that has been my default, to just to let that go. And the more, but lately, not that I have an answer. I'm and I'm a therapist, and we're about to talk about doing therapy with multicultural couples, and see what we can learn here. But I know there's something more. There's a door open to me, and I hope to open that door a little bit for you as well, to realize, hey, I could actually be experiencing some privileged blindness. Maybe I don't understand black persons or Asian persons or whatever as clearly as I thought I did. And for me, it's a eye-opening kind of a, in some sense, bad, but a glorious thing. Like, wow, I'm learning that Curtis lives in a different world than I do. I want it to be fair and good for him, but getting to know Curtis means I'm going to a new planet, so to speak. I'm going to a different place. I want to know what it's like to be him. And before, I think, of course I understand him. And so I like the not knowing. Well, let's turn to the third page, please, of your handout. Thank you for comments, by the way. And about the what? I would like to hear. Let's get into this piece here and see how our time goes. I think we're going to have time for questions, but you're going to have to use a microphone. I think folks in the back probably missed what Brenna was saying, so we'll get you mic'd somehow from Mike Hillerman. Oh, Bill, don't do that. I'm sorry. Well, it's time to begin under workshop content. Well, the problem with that, Mike, is I'm not allowed past those speakers. So may I? You told me you were going to hurt me if I came past the speakers. So no. It's time to look at some of these ideas, these principles, racialization, blindness, and think about them with some specificity. How do they merge into therapy, and what will we do with them? So where we'll pick that up will be under the title workshop content, the planned steps to reach goals noted above. Item two says, consideration of you with what this is what we'll be doing here right now is an explanation of what's happening. Consideration of the unique potential relational influences of racialization on African American middle class persons. A sample of such influences follows, especially the negative marital impact of certain American racial phenomenon. some focus point examples below. Excuse me, some focus points examples follow. Each of the points below are cited in the research as contributing to marital relational dissatisfaction. Okay, so we're thinking about multiracial couples now, and relationship dissatisfaction. I believe these types of information will increase our therapist's multicultural clarity. Before we look at the lettered items, when I'm thinking about multiracial counseling of couples, I'm thinking of virtually all possible variables where the therapist is white and the couple is not white. They're non-white or Asian, Hispanic, black couple. So that's multiracial relative to the therapist and the client. Also thinking about clients where the couple themselves are multiracial relative to each other. And so you could easily, in that situation, have three cultures sitting right there. And Elena mentioned earlier that she's Korean and her husband is Ghanaian. Ooh, yeah. Yeah, should they be counseling with Aaron back there? And that would be a very diverse situation. So we're talking about those kinds of situations as well. Although I will focus mostly on African Americans, since for my students and for so many people at this conference, be a high concentration of African American clients that you would be dealing with. A, unique models of marriage and gender role implications in many Black American homes. When I say unique, obviously my own privileged bias is coming through, unique relative to white culture, perhaps. 46% of African American families are headed by females, with male partners absent. I actually maybe could qualify for the first part of that sentence myself. My wife's a very wise woman, and maybe she's the head of our household at times. It ought to be. Not in the biblical violation way, of course. By the way, that always is a mystery, isn't it? You know that you're so many times I'd be at work all day, or maybe out for a couple of days on a little trip or something, and I come back and I have two little boys, and there's my wife, and she's running the household fine, probably more orderly than when I was there, and I presto bango, I'm the head. Well. What do you mean? She knows more about these kids. She knows what the schedule is. What's a head look like in a situation like that? Well, I'm going to leave you with that. Kids left now, so we don't have to worry about that. 67% of African American children live in single parent homes. So that's going to be a unique feature, perhaps. Well, no doubt. B, generational history and particular life experience of racism and discrimination effects on marital trust. Interesting topic and article referenced here. Yeah, so this is new for me, but if I grow up in a racialized society, if I grow up being misunderstood, stood regularly, being thought of as a criminal, typically. I mean, how many? There are not very many Black men who haven't been stopped because they were in a neighborhood that a policeman thought a Black person wouldn't be living or driving through. So if I grow up with that, how is that going to affect trust in my own home? I'm not sure, but I'm thinking that there's something special there, especially bad. The high incidence of educational, this is a fascinating variable here. the high incidence of educational disparity between African-American women and men. Black women hold a large lead over black men in almost every facet of higher education. Black women currently earn about two-thirds of all African-American bachelor's degrees, 70% of all master's degrees, and currently earn about two-thirds of all African-American bachelor degree awards, okay, 70% of master's degrees, and more than 60% of all doctorates. Black women also hold a majority of all African-American enrollments in law, medical, and dental schools. Brenna's comment a moment ago about affirmative action and women being benefiting from that. That is not my cultural norm. And to be armed with that information, if I'm seeing an African-American couple, or if I'm going to Stephanie's church and I'm doing a couples seminar, it's a very high probability that the men and women sitting in front of me, at least a large percentage, will have that sort of disparity that I wasn't expecting unless I read that research. D, next page. I already mentioned a fairly wide, a very wide wealth gap between black and white, and this is just the update that I told you about, the more recent statistic. The widening financial security gap between majority and minority U.S. cultures and its effect on marital stress and relationships. I'm sorry. Everybody have that cut off? Let me see how much is cut off. Okay. All right. Well, you missed the unimportant part. The unimportant part was simply a statement that the gap is widening between black and white families, and then the data is at the two bullet points. From 2010 to 2013, the median wealth of white households increased by 2.4%. And as you can see, the numbers are fairly hefty. From 2010 to 2013, the median wealth of black households fell from 16 to 11,000, a 33.7 decrease. And I believe other information in that article talked about the loss of homes through the financial reversal that we had in our country and the loan situation. Most Americans have most of their assets tied up in home ownership, and it was African-American families lost larger than white families, as you can see from the numbers there. Here's one I referenced earlier, but let's look at it more closely. Collectivization and individualism in black and non-black culture clients, especially considered, will be the interaction between the following. Well, client financial resources, we're already talking about that, and there's a disparity, obviously, we were already talking about that, between black and non-black culture clients. And then there's family of origin commitments. This research suggests that the family of origin commitments are, I don't think it's fair to say, you know, stronger, better, worse, but are different in the cultures. And here's would be one illustration. The high probability that one or both partners will have at least one impoverished family member. Now, the financial situation isn't all that strong to begin with, but there is... you know, think about the white families that you know and your friends and at church and so forth. And then think about black families you know, especially if you go to Redeemer or some church that's somewhat mixed racially and you know, have a broader scope of knowledge of folks. fascinating to think that there's a high probability that at least one of the partners will have an impoverished family member. They'll have that extra stress of that impoverished family member. They'll have the extra financial burden of that impoverished family member. Would be rather, in some cases, wouldn't it be rather amazing that they're even making it to therapy, given their financial situation? Armed with those pieces of information, now we're going to do something a little different, maybe still. We're not going outside again. But if you are a practicing therapist, either as a second year student in this program here at RTS, or in any other capacity, if you are a practicing therapist and you have any degree of familiarity with emotionally focused couples therapy, would you please rise? Don't be shy. Okay. Look at them. There's a lot of you. I'm almost going with 50% here. So what I would like you to stay risen. You folks have had some experience with the learning about Sue Johnson's model of emotion-focused therapy, and I would like you to have a partner. So look around, folks. Find someone and partner with them. You folks continue standing. It looks like we could have groups, groups of two. In every little group, might be two or might be three, I would like someone to be one of you therapists. Okay, so will you, you therapists just stand there, and you other folks go to them now and partner up. Was that clear at all? Did that make sense? You four are a group. Would you mind passing out? There's enough for everyone to have one. I think we may have some groups that are therapist rich and some groups that are therapist poor. Try to keep your group to three, maybe four max. Like, you know, they have 20 people in this group here. I don't know what's going on. I'm kidding. Just giving you a hard time. Okay, have you got a group? Hello, Jay. Who's that lady next to you there? I think so, Sarah Ryber. Ready? So good to see you people. Yeah, I heard there was trouble back here. Probably Joseph. Yeah. All right. May I have one? You will recognize these as the nine steps of emotionally focused therapy. Emotionally focused therapy, if you've never heard of it before, it's a very user-friendly model of therapy. There's a lot of joining and responding, and as our students unfortunately say, there's a lot of car cuffing at the beginning of it. There's a lot of helping people get to feelings and share vulnerable feelings. Oh, Pam. Sharing vulnerable feelings as what Sue Johnson calls at softening moments. So, Nicole's here. Sandy, oh goodness, what is this? It's supposed to be an alumni conference. This is great. So what I'd like you to do is look at these steps, bring what you know about them, but then try to integrate some of the pieces of information about multiculturalism that we have discussed, especially the, well, I'd like to say it this way. Look at EFT or look at couples therapy. In fact, if you don't like EFT, you can just do your own brand of couples therapy. Look at couples therapy through the lens of racialization and what these persons have probably lived with and live with in their culture and some of the data that we just considered in those 5 points. So what I want to get to is that I think if we have expanded our own vision about multicultural issues sufficiently, we'll be looking at our therapy through a different lens. There'll be other data. We'll be curious about our clients, but we'll have a kind of a multiculturally guided curiosity. So let your curiosity around multicultural issues guide you. Hello, Savannah. What you need? We need another one? Now, by the way, a little news flash. As my brother John Evans hands me a paper, I wanted to announce to you that John was telling me during the break that Prepare and Rich is touting at least their multicultural breadth, that they're robust across culture. So that'd be a good thing for you to keep an eye on and check out their literature, Prepare and Rich. But for now, develop an EFT plan that's seen through the lens, inspired by some of the multicultural things we've talked about today. Go. Hello, Denise. A further word of instruction would probably be useful. You have to create the client. So you create a client, and they can be a different culture from you, or they can be a different culture from each other. Either way. In fact, I think I would prefer the latter because it's trickier. But you've got to generate a model of a client. Step one. Step two, heal them. Thank you for doing this. I would love to hear some creativity that working on some therapy, somebody tell me something that you came up with that was a little different that you might normally do with a client. My esteem depends upon it. Otherwise, you know, you learn nothing practical at my event. Question was, can you report to us something that you all decided to do a little differently than you might not have done because you were multiculturally informed?
I don't know if this is like actually something we discussed that we would do.
It doesn't matter. I need someone to talk now. Otherwise, it's just, it's very awkward. Yes, so thankful for all responsible people.
Is it on?
Okay. We kind of talked about how we're told about the awareness wheel, or like the best ways to communicate with each other. And we've learned like nonverbal cues are very, very important, but communication styles in different cultures are very different. So for me, when somebody raises a voice in my house, my blood pressure goes up. I'm like, ooh, something's going on. Loud voices. So how do you tell somebody who maybe in their culture like raised tones or what to me would be like critical language might be more acceptable to them. Like, if we're informing them on these better communication styles, but if that like is against their, like goes totally against their cultural way of communicating.
Yes, Anne would like to answer that. Oh. Somebody, Dia would probably do really good with that one.
Oh, no, I was not clued in. I'm so sorry.
Someone who has a Hungarian background would like to answer this. Hungarians, my grandmother was Hungarian, and I knew she was because every time she got angry, it came out Hungarian. Yes. I don't know why that mic didn't sound like it was working. But.
It's not.
Someone else with... was Marty, Mrs. Marty Witherow, who responded with that she would act like to suspend judgment about that being appropriate or inappropriate, even if it was triggering something inside of her, and see what it was like for the spouse to hear that. See if we can find out what was triggered in the spouse. How'd I do, Marty? That's good. John Evans.
Another way that I would say that is always adopt the posture of being a student.
Yeah, well, that has to fit perfectly, doesn't it, right there with multicultural issues. Always adopt the posture of being a student. So if someone is just seemingly loud and inappropriate and you're wondering, does this, you know, are they Italian? Does this work in their house? What would a student look like there? They're really loud, and you're wondering, that may be inappropriate, that may be damaging relationally, but I want to be a student.
I would ask them to teach me about their culture. What does that mean in their culture?
Oh, yeah. Okay, there's a lot of volume. Okay, I'm role-playing John's answer. There's a lot of volume, a lot of emotion in that. This, right now, this what you just said, the way you expressed it, what does that mean in your cultures? I think we're in different cultural worlds here. So tell me a little bit about what that means. Okay, Ron.
Well, and then what does the other partner hear when they hear that volume?
Yeah, and that was Marty too. You two were on the same wavelength.
So how's that working?
Dr. Phil. don't do Dr. Phil with me. That's upsetting. My bias. We're not in the same culture, Dr. Phil and I.
Well, tell me how you feel about it.
Yes.
I know to be a student, but I'm not sure that I would ask, how is that in your culture? Because I'm thinking, because to me, that means, okay, this is a person who's already judged me about something. And you can ask me how that is for me, how that was in my family or whatever, but asking me about my culture, I'm sorry, then what you've done is you put a gap between us and it may not ever be taken down or whatever.
Might as well get a desk.
Get a what?
Get a desk in between.
Yes.
Get a desk in between. Yeah.
So sorry.